Hey, Documentary First listeners. I am excited to announce that our podcast is now officially sponsored by our friends over at Artillery Sports. And the Artillery Sports 5-star series pickleballs have now arrived. But here's the most important part, and it's what I absolutely love. With each purchase, 20% of the profits are donated to organizations that help military veterans get low or no-cost healthcare. So head on over to artillerysports.com right now and use the code DOCFIRST to get 10% off your first order. Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host and documentary filmmaker, Christian Taylor. My co-host, Jason Rugg, is out again this week, faithfully tending to his family, so please keep him in your prayers. And before I introduce you to our extremely interesting guest this week, I'd like to give you a quick company update. So I'm thrilled to announce to you that with the help of my incredible crew, we are finally releasing the trailer for our upcoming documentary, Heroes of Carentan. It is completed and ready for prime time. So keep an eye out on our socials for this exciting window into our next exciting doc. Additionally, I'm happy to announce that The Girl Who Wore Freedom is finally getting its first nationwide limited theatrical release, beginning in the first week of May and the first week of June in theaters all across the U.S., If you would like The Girl Who Wore Freedom to come to your neck of the woods, write me at christian@documentaryfirst.com. Let us know the theater and someone to contact, and we'll reach out to you on your behalf and try to get a screening in your neighborhood. The last, but certainly not least, in fact, it's probably the most important, the Documentary First team has the privilege of taking 100-year-old World War II veteran C.O. Bauer back to Normandy for D-Day this June. Many of you may remember, if you've seen our film, C.O. Bauer was our amazing veteran near the end of the film. So we're thrilled to take him back to Normandy. That's it for my company update. Now we are going to jump into our podcast this week. I am thrilled to welcome the producer, director, and writer of this amazing movie, Mad Props, and the star of this upcoming documentary. This is being distributed by Virgil Films. And again, the name of it is Mad Props. So welcome to you, Juan Pablo Reynoso and Tom Biacchini.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
Hey, thank you for having us.
Yeah. It is so nice to have you here. I have to tell you, I always wait to the last minute to watch films because I want to be excited and want to remember everything about these films. I watched it last night. I from the moment, like the first, I would say, 3 minutes in, I was hooked. Oh. I called Joe Amadei and Tim over at Virgil Films, and I was like, who are these guys? This movie's awesome. Tell me more. I just thought it was a creative idea. It was super well done. I thought, you people are crazy. Like, I cannot believe these people existed. It showed me this whole new world. So I'm really excited to talk to you about it. I want to start with you, Tom, first, because it seems like this was your idea. So tell us the idea of Mad Props, how you came up with it, and then we'll jump on to how this became a film.
Sure. And thank you for having us on. And thank you for the interest and the nice comments about the documentary. When I was a kid, when I was a child, I wanted to be a special effects artist for horror movies. So I used to create these props to be on horror sets. So zombies, arms moving, fingers moving, you name it. That's what I wanted to do. And I grew out of that, but I always had this artistic side of me. And I took that out a lot on, you know, playing the guitar, the piano, and collecting. And collecting, it's not just about buying the objects, it's about displaying them and putting it together. And I guess it didn't click to me until I was in my 40s, being like, you know, I've got a, what is this? I think it's the artistic side of me. But in collecting movie props, which I've been doing for, I bought my first one probably 20 years ago. In collecting movie props, it was that same outlet. And it brought me back to my childhood of wanting to own a little piece of the movies and be a part of the movies in some sort of way. Not as an actor, but as a creator. And anyways, I had been part of this worldwide auction from the prop store, which is on the documentary. And I thought it was just so fascinating that I'm bidding against people all around the world. And there's this whole underground society of people that are really into these movie props and the prices are ridiculous. And no one's talking about it. I just think that's crazy. I'll tell somebody, hey, I got the whip from Indiana Jones. Like, how did you come across that? How is that possible? And so anyways, I had finished a business deal and it was a stressful first quarter of, I hope I'm getting my years right, 2022. And I woke up on a Saturday morning and I started writing a script. I'm like, I want to do something more creative with my life. And I started writing this kind of high level summary of a TV show. It was actually a TV show. It's almost like American Pickers, right? You're going from the person who got the thing and then the selling process and authenticating it and all that. And wanted to go around the globe doing that. And I sent it to Juan. Juan is one of the most talented directors in the state of Oklahoma. And I knew him when I was younger. And he said, Tom, why don't we make this in a documentary first? He said, that way you have something, a product, you know, it's almost like a base. And if a TV show comes from that, great. I handed it over to Juan, and Juan really did all the heavy lifting, finding the collectors, and our whole journey was Juan's undertaking.
Yeah, well, I'm going to introduce Ron, and I'm actually going to go back and read your bio, because we spent time crafting these, and I was so impressed. When I first read your bio, Tom, I was like, what's this guy doing? Why am I interviewing him? This is before I watched your film, because it didn't seem like at all I should be interviewing you, and of course, till I watched the movie. So I'm going to read your bio. Tom is the chairman of Vast Bank in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he stands out not only for his leadership in the financial sector, but also for his remarkable journey as a collector and an enthusiast of cinematic art. Inspired by this early fascination with special effects makeup and horror movies, which you'll learn about in Mad Props, Tom's deep appreciation for filmmaking is evident in this film. His passion for cinema led him to be the executive producer of Mad Props. He's a multi-talented professional. He's currently the chairman of Vast Bank in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he's also actively involved in philanthropy, which just warms my heart. He's chairing the board for the Tulsa Regional Chamber and other boards, such as the Day Center for the Homeless. Thank you so much for doing that. I love that, Tom. As a distinguished alumnus of the University of Notre Dame, Tom's diverse background includes stints as a financial analyst at Jones Lang and LaSalle in Chicago. Woohoo, go Chicago. And a lawyer at Crow Dunleavy and Stuart Bielkini. I can't even say your last name. Stuart Bielkini and Turner. Thank you so much. I'm sorry I didn't get that in the beginning, but that is an impressive bio.
Well, thank you.
All right. Now we are going to turn it to Juan, and I'm going to do your bio up front, Juan, before, so I don't have to do it on the backside. All right. So Juan has an impressive bio as well. Juan is an award-winning writer, producer, and director with a global reputation in commercials and films, mentored by esteemed directors Larry Zacharo and Michael Mayer during his theatrical training at Fordham University. His solid foundation led to a versatile career spanning feature films, TV, music videos, and stage productions. His achievements, off-Broadway productions like Death of a Salesman and Playing Tennis with God, have been incredible. His filmography boasts critically acclaimed projects like Made in Japan, Snowfall, Last Night in Warsaw, and Flowers for Norma. Upcoming works like Theirs with Rita Moreno, Harvey Keitel, Udo Kier, and Rosalind Sanchez, Cry Baby Hill, Whirlwind, Motel de Gracia, The First Day, 9/11, 25 years later, are eagerly awaited. Throughout his career, Reynoso has consistently blended artistic passion with human integrity, leaving a lasting impact on the arts. And I am sad to say that I haven't seen any of those yet, but now after seeing Mad Props, which is a fun and entertaining documentary, I can't wait to see the rest of your works. Juan, thank you so much for being on the show, and I can't wait to learn some stuff from you.
Yeah, it's very bizarre hearing our bios read back to us.
I know as a person, when you're listening to your bios, it seems crazy because we're just people.
Yeah. No,
we're just people.
Makes me want to puke.
And we've done some stuff, and we are not the sum of our achievements. We're just people.
Yep. And yeah, you know, I didn't list any of my failures on there.
Exactly.
There's a long
exactly.
list.
You know, the reason I do this podcast is because of my failures. No, it really is. This podcast was born out of my failures.
For and sure. Well, that's how we learn. Yeah.
It is. I've been talking to my 22-year-old, who may kill me because I'm saying this, but he's having a terrible time in college right now. Every day he's anxious. He feels like he's a failure, and he just he wants to drop out or quit lacrosse. And I'm just agonizing with him as I'm hearing this. And I realized the other day, I'm the same way. I am you know, filled with fear over failures and messing up. And, you know, but I keep telling him our failures are what lead us to our good things and our successes. And that's probably true for you guys, I would say.
Well, that's actually one of my favorite quotes and that I live by is, you know, Samuel Beckett. Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail again, fail better.
I like that.
It's like a mantra of mine.
Say it one more time so it sinks into my brain.
Oh, sure. Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better.
I love that. There's another quote that says, fail early, fail often, so that you can get on with what you need to do. That's a business quote. So how do you guys know each other? I heard Tom say that you guys have been friends for a really long time. How did that happen?
Well, there's an S&M club. So Tom is the little brother of not a classmate, but he was a year above me in school. And so, and then also our families, his cousins, and I have literally since nursery school. So basically we've all been, you know, and we're also like, like one of three or four or five, like hardcore Roman Catholic or Tom's case, Irish Catholic, families, with, you know, too many kids. So, so we're in that circle. Growing up. So that's how we knew each other, but we hadn't actually spoken to each other in truth or like 25 years or so, even though we knew of each other obviously, but we hadn't really spoken in that long. So doing this project is how we reconnected. Cause I came back in New York and then I started coming back to Tulsa to take care of my parents. And then that's when we reconnected and then the rest is history.
So Tom, did you think when you had this idea, like on that creative day, you're like, okay, I've got this TV series. Who can I help? Who can I get to help me? And then you just pick up the phone and call Juan?
Yep. Well, Juan and I, to be fair, we were already talking about some horror movies. He was talking about Crybaby Hill to me and so on and so forth. And I was just fascinated because I've always wanted to be a part of a horror movie. Going back to what I told you earlier, as a kid, wanting to be on the set of horror movies. So we started talking then. And he was the first person I thought of. And like, I'm going to go to Juan. So
now Juan, when he came to you with this idea, did you think he was crazy or did you think, hey, this might be really good? Did you think I've got some really serious work going on? Cause if I listen to all the stuff you've listed off, I mean, it's pretty heavy stuff as opposed to a doc. What did you think when he came and brought it to you?
Oh no, I mean, I'm pretty sure, right, Tom? I mean, I loved it from the get-go. The only thing I didn't, I thought was fascinating, partly because I'm not a collector. I'm still not a collector. It's not of any interest to me. Like, for me, it's just the most I've ever collected are magnets. Anytime I go to a new city for work or fun, I just make sure I get a magnet. That's it. It was a world that I knew existed, but I didn't know to what extent. And then I thought it sounded super interesting. And then he originally wanted to do it as like a pilot. And I said, I told him, I was like, well, the two hardest aspects of this business for anybody to invest in would be the music industry and then TV. It's just impossible. They're like so hard to get into. So I said, why don't we try making it as a doc first? Because then from a business standpoint, because he's also a businessman on top of his creative side, it would make more sense to do that. Then we have product that we can actually take to networks and streamers as a sort of, you know, pitch for a TV show.
Yeah. So Tom, it sounds like to me you bought that idea because here we have this documentary. But at first, did that, like, were you on board with that or did you fight back?
No, I didn't fight. No. I mean, okay. I have to trust, you know, Juan's been doing this his entire life. So I just kind of had to trust him. And a documentary sounded just fine to me.
Yeah. Well, I just love it. You know, you have been so fascinated with film. Yes, you did start off with horror movies. Yes, this is about props. But here you are with a film, an executive producer. But not only that, You were an actor in this film, and I got to tell you, you were really good. I mean, if you're just listening to this podcast, you may not see him, but he's a very handsome individual. He has a great voice, as you can tell from listening. But it is not easy to be a host. And you were a host in this documentary, as well as telling this deeply personal story. And what I loved about what you did, and it's not true in a lot of documentaries, is there was this seamless ability for you to move between being with your family and talking to them about what you were going to do, to being a host in a prop house and asking questions. I mean, It was very impressive. I could certainly buy you being a host of a television series. There's not any question. Is that your first experience as doing that acting thing?
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. I think it's really
true. I don't give it out unless it's true.
He's a total natural.
I'm watching over here.
You were.
It's funny. So yes, this is my first time doing something like this. But I also do a lot of public speaking for work.
That makes sense.
Really helped a lot. And I do a lot of, you know, just being an attorney and it's that I have been on film quite a bit. And I also, like, as a kid, I was the star of the every play I was in. I was in the star. You know what I mean? And I didn't have
okay.
that. Like, I promise you, I'm not good at that many things, but I just happen to have the personality for it, I suppose.
Yeah. Yep. Well, really, it was great. I don't say things unless I really mean them. And I think you carried the film. And there were a lot of other wonderful people in there. I was shocked. I was actually really shocked with the people that you talked to. I mean, holy cow, Mickey Rourke is in this film. That was like, whoa, he was at the end. And I was like, what a shock. The people that you talked to, I was super surprised about. Did you know, Juan, that he was going to handle this so smoothly? Or were you skeptical that he could carry this?
No, I wasn't necessarily skeptical. It was interesting. Tom, by the way, and he will never say this, he's actually one of the most humble and people there are. And he doesn't assume anything. And so when he pitched himself as the host and stuff, he also treated it as like, look, you know, I know they've never done this. And then if we do a show, obviously I know this is kind of like an audition and all that stuff too. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. So I was like, I wasn't 100% positive, but based on the fact that he presents himself like so well, you know, he's just so well put together that I wasn't nervous about it. But I was slightly impressed on just how much of a natural he was. Because he is. He's a total natural.
I mean, I took, you know, I don't know how many years of acting. I've done it for 40 years. I could not have done as well as he did. I really don't think so, because he was so relaxed. He really was just himself. He's just like he is now. And I think that's what made it. I was relaxed. I was relaxed watching it. And I was really drawn into the story, I think, because his excitement and his love for that, you know, I love at the end. Yeah. Where you did the, how you kept going after the credits with all of the bloopers and things like that, which are so fun, but it's, oh no way. You know, I already thought that during the show. I'm like, how many times does he say that? But it's true. You know, you're like a little kid. You're genuinely like a little kid seeing things that you can't really believe. And
he was super embarrassed by that at first too. He was like, oh my God, no, don't focus on that stuff. I was like, trust me, Tom, it's so endearing.
Yeah.
And so he was like, he kind of hated me that I was going to do this little montage in the credits, but it's like one of the things everybody talks about. It's like, it's almost my favorite part was the credits. The credits were so great.
The funny thing is,
it's like when you hear yourself, it's like, if somebody's not hearing their voice and they hear it, they don't like it.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever you see yourself on film, I mean, trust me, the next time around is going to be a lot different, because now I've noticed all the little things that I do as a human being and the things I say. No way. Well, that's just my natural, like, somebody comes in here and tells me a cool story, I'm like, no way.
Don't change yourself, Tom. Don't change yourself. That's what's endearing about you. Well, you know, Juan, what I loved was the storytelling, quite frankly. You know, I know that you are the director, the producer, probably the writer. Did you edit this as well?
No, I mean, I was intimately involved with I did edit the credits.
Okay.
And I was obviously
totally worth watching.
yeah, as the director, I was obviously very intimately involved with the edit. But no, my talented friends in New York at Floodlight Creative Services, they're the ones that oversaw the editing and stuff. So yeah. But what's interesting is the way I approach it, and it's kind of the way I approach when I'm doing narrative stuff too, is that I like to allow for organic stuff. So obviously you want to get the stuff that's scripted and everything first so you have it. But then I always want to make sure that I allow my talent to do things organically themselves and how it may come. So, and oftentimes that winds up being, you know, the best part, the best take is the stuff that you just let them have that creative freedom. So I approached, and it's a risky way to do a doc, I know, is we went into this doc without a script.
Okay.
So we had the framework, right? And we knew like the basics. I knew I wanted to get, you know, interviews with curators and museum directors and then artists behind the creation of the props. And then obviously the collectors. But I didn't know where that was going to go. And, you know, people would ask, do you have questions? Do you want to give me in advance? And I said, no, I don't want to give you questions in advance because I want this to be as organic and real as humanly possible. And so when we shot, man, we shot. So, I mean, it wasn't like a haphazard type thing, obviously, because you had the framework, but we filmed so much stuff. There's easily another, you know, 50 hours worth of stuff that's not even in the film.
Do you know how many terabytes you have on your RAID drive?
Yeah, we have eight terabytes.
Eight terabytes.
Yeah, it was a lot. Yeah. And so it wasn't until the end, and as we were going too, you know, I had producers especially when we were in London, I knew that the prop store was going to be part of the last thing in the film to kind of sum it all up, to show that community. Because in my research and all that stuff, prepping for the whole shoot and stuff, it was a community that was very suspicious of me at first, until one of them did their own due diligence and said, hey guys, we can trust this guy. He's legit. Then I was welcomed into the community. And
wow.
And then, so when we were filming at the prop store, my London producer was basically going around and meeting individual people and stuff to kind of get their stories about why they were there and whatnot. And so when we met Alistair, who's one of the last people interviewed, yeah. When I heard his story, I was like, oh my God, we have to interview him.
Is he the guy who's never been in there and he saw the little drawing that has that, his name related? Yeah.
Yeah. And so he, to me, was like the heart of the film. Like that was the emotional core, because he's the everyman who, you know, sort of reflects what's the beauty about this community is it seems so outlandish, the money spent and all this stuff. But then you have this other guy who literally makes, you know, McDonald wages. He's got some certain disabilities or disadvantages himself. And so he was like a perfect reflection of how this is a community for everybody. Everybody is welcome. And to me, that was like part of the most heartwarming thing about this whole experience. And that's when we went back, and then we went back and in post, and I spent, I don't know, Tom, what, like 2-3 weeks or so working on the script. But I had to go through obviously all the footage, had everything transcribed, et cetera, et cetera, as filmmakers know, and you're logging everything and blah, blah, blah. And then I started reading through everything, all the transcripts, and then I started piecing together from there the story. And like the first version of the script was like 280 pages. This is like, I was like, my editor's like, it's like, dude, I'm not doing that for you. That's ridiculous. I was like, fair enough. And plus we didn't want to make it wasn't a doc series at the time. Right. So we wanted to make a solid 90 to 100 minute movie. And so we just pared it down from there, tightened things up, and really got to the crux of the story. And then I wrote the voiceover that Tom does, you know, that's literally the only stuff that was written specifically for the thing that was like, quote unquote, you know, rehearsed, well, if you will.
And what's interesting is even in the voiceover, it doesn't feel like it was voiceover. I mean, I'm a voiceover actress. I've studied this. I don't know how long. It is not easy to make it just sound like you're just talking.
But yeah.
He, he did that, and he doesn't sound any different than when he's talking on camera to his family. I mean,
that was the thing. I had to tell him while we were doing it too. Like he started coming at it as an actor rather than just talk.
Ah, so and you so, did have to coach him through. So
we had not a bunch. I would basically say, no, Tom, just talk to us, be Tom. And then that's how you got Tom.
Yeah. Well, you did it. You did it. You had a good coach, Tom. Heading into the heart of this story, we've just talked about the story, which was, I loved your process. Thank you for sharing that with us. Very organic and oftentimes the way docs do happen. When you started out, did anything change? You know how that's what happens a lot in documentaries. You think you've got a story and you dig into it and you realize, huh, it squirted out this way. We better track this lead down and it kind of turns out differently. Or is it exactly like you planned it from the beginning?
I don't think there's any dramatic change at all.
No, there wasn't one moment where we said, oh my gosh, it's going this way. This is the way we got to go now. I don't recall that being the case at all. I was pretty impressed though. I was involved a lot when I finally got the script, like all the narration, breaking that down with Juan. Well, he did the first draft, but then I got involved in that on how it would play out because I cared about those sort of things, although I was following Juan's lead because he's done it before. But I don't think there was anything that we had to pivot on. I will say this, I was super impressed with Juan, how he put so much together, like Alec Gillis, like how we saw two of his pieces at two different parts of the world.
How and all the of a sudden now
he's talking about it. That was all Juan.
That was crazy. Like, seriously, the way that you pieced that together really blew my mind. And I loved the flashbacks that you were talking about one prop and then all of a sudden, you know, now you're talking to the person that made it. And then we're flashing back to when you talked about it before. That was super cool. Did you know from the beginning you were going to get those interviews or you were going to go there? Was that all in the plan from the beginning?
No, and a lot of because we shot the majority of the collector stuff first. The U.S. stuff was like the first stuff we shot. So when they mentioned Alec Gillis, I knew who he was. But then when they mentioned him, Jacob and Nick in Colorado mentioned that and showed the Goro mechanical item, then that's when I was like, all right, I definitely got to get Alec. And that's how that came about. So
yeah, that was really awesome.
I mean, you can go, there's a laundry list of amazingly talented people like Alec, obviously. Right. So yeah.
And I gotta say, it was a childhood dream of mine to be able to hang out.
I was thinking about that, Tom.
Yeah.
I was like, he must be like through the roof crazy. I don't know how you kept your cool enough to be on there, because here you are in this prop house talking to a prop master, designing all these toys, trying on the hands, you know, in a movie. Yeah. What was going through your mind?
It was just super fun for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the type of stuff you'd sit back and be like, man, I'd love to have your career. You know, obviously it's too late now, but it was just super fun. But like Robert Englund, for instance, who played Freddy Krueger, I had Freddy Krueger all over my wall. I had a 6-foot cutout of him in my room when I was a kid. And to be able to interview him and to be on the show that I'm hosting, yes, that's like a dream come true. Super fun.
He's
great, by the way.
He was great. I really loved all the people that you talked to. They were fascinating characters. Well, you know, I was so curious about, and I know you probably don't want to share your budget, but I got to say, it looked like an incredibly expensive film because you had all of these clips from all these different movies in your film. You traveled to all these different places. I mean, how in the world were you able to make this film?
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Tom. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I'll hand this over to Juan. I will say we can't talk about the budget, but I will say that Juan did an exceptional job of saving money, of, you know, it's everything from the hotels we sleep in to how we're traveling to how much we can film in one day. And then he did so much of the work himself. he delegated some work, but a lot of it he was doing it himself. And so that helped it to do that. Sorry, Juan, go ahead.
No. I think there's only one hotel that was a mistake putting us into. the one that smelled like feet, right, Tom?
Yes.
and our cinematographer went into the bathroom in his hotel room, and somebody had kissed. There was like a lipstick kiss mark on the thing and on the mirror in the bathroom. It's like, dude, what? And something was written. I can't remember what it was, but it was just like.
It was like you were in your own horror story.
Yeah, I was like, what on earth happened here? Anyway, sorry. But yeah, no, the you know, admittedly, the travel portion, you know, you have to, it's a lot of, and from, this is all from the producerial side of things and stuff. It's a lot. It can be very complicated, but thankfully, you know, with my experience, just in my career of how to find deals for travel and this and that, and, you know, there's ways around, you know, like, are your baggage fees when you're traveling with gear? How do you keep your baggage fees from, like, it's just stuff you have to really explore and stuff. Because sometimes, you know, there were a few times where I was able to put the entire crew in first class because it was actually cheaper to fly first class than it was to pay for the baggage fees. So it was
interesting.
Like, yeah, there's like these little nuances. So if you know what you're doing as a producer, you always have to explore every option and know that no option is ridiculous. Just like there's no stupid questions, right?
Right.
And you can go, and that's why I said to myself, I was like, I wonder, I think, what if first class is like, you know, I did it, and then we wound up saving hundreds of dollars on certain legs of the trip.
I would have never thought of that.
It's a really interesting, yeah, these loopholes that exist. But it only works for certain things. It's not always like that, obviously, right?
Sure.
But travel was by far the most expensive, obviously, portion of it. And you could have argued, oh, you might have been able to save money if you only used crew in each city that you went to locally, right? But our crew was so small that I thought, you know what, it makes... I think from a creative standpoint, I liked the idea of making sure that we had a sort of family atmosphere, which I like on all my sets, period.
Mm-hmm.
But that I thought the consistency was important in maintaining that tone throughout the entire shoot. So that's, you know, normally it's not that it's bad for you to hire locally everywhere you go, because I mean, from a normal standpoint, I would say yes, but this was one of those rare circumstances where I was like, no, I think it's better that we try and be as consistent as humanly possible in the way we approach it and stuff. So,
yeah, I feel the same way. I'm a heavy believer on, you know, building that family and taking them with you if at all possible, for sure. Well, talk to me about how long this film took from conception to, you know, pre and principal and post and then what happened afterwards.
So we started in, I think, what was it, like April you pitched it to me, 2022?
Yep.
We started shooting in July of 22. And then the film was locked, done, and delivered by the end of August. I'm sorry, no, the beginning of August, 23.
That's crazy. Are you kidding?
No, it was pretty fast. And that's funny because when you look at one of my other docs, Made in Japan took 13 years to make.
Yeah.
So it's just like everything's different. But this was like one of those things that just was just super smooth and came together so quickly.
That's beautiful.
So, yeah, it was just, you know, it was very fortunate.
Now, and then
we had a good support base because Tom, you know, Tom was our support base for getting it made, right? So, you know, I'm very fortunate in that sense that we had that, whereas, you know, a lot of people don't have that going in. So
sure.
Yeah.
Well, and did you do the film festival circuit?
We did. We oddly enough, you know, it's funny, is so right now, as of this interview, we're still sitting at 100% freshness on Rotten Tomatoes. But
wow,
for some reason, we did not get into any of the biggies. They all turned us down. But we've gotten into just about every one of the small ones, right? So It's just really weird. It's just one of these things that it's subjective, you know, and it's also programming too. A lot of people, like filmmakers, shouldn't get disheartened. I mean, yes, of course, it's a bummer if you don't get into South By. And I thought because Made in Japan had been South By, maybe that legacy thing would, I'd get in, but nope, didn't help. It's oftentimes, it's not even about the quality of your film. It's about programming too. Like, it's literally sometimes like down to the minute they're programming stuff, not just based on quality and what they like, but also based on just being able to like literally fit it in the block that they want to fit it into. So like, you know, for all of the filmmakers out there and stuff, don't take it personally if they, you know, if you don't get it out there.
Let me ask you this honest opinion. Your film is lighthearted. It's fun. It's uplifting. It has a warm, you know, heartfelt message. Those same things were true of mine. I found it very difficult to get into film festivals because a lot of them I felt were focused on uncovering horrible things or, you know, injustices. I mean, do you feel like that's true, that a lot of the film festivals are really focusing on that heavy stuff and they prioritize that over subject matters like yours?
They do. Like you, from one year to the next, they might focus on certain things more than others, right? Like they might be a little bit more comedic or one year versus the next. And then it's just, honestly, it's just a crapshoot. There's no, you can't predict the whim of these festivals. And so like I think the only time you're guaranteed to get into anything is as if you're a celebrity, you know, that's really
right. And did you have distribution before the film festival?
We got distribution pretty quick after we started submitting.
Okay.
So that was Virgil came on board. I think when Virgil came on board, we had submitted to just like, we'd only started submitting like maybe a couple of weeks before that. So yeah, no, we got it pretty early on our distribution. So,
but usually, you know, those that have celebrities in them, if they also have distribution from Netflix or Amazon, you know, those are the ones that are getting in and pushing out anybody else, you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's don't talk about that anymore. Let's talk about Rotten Tomatoes, because like you said, you're 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I've never been able to get a review. We are 0% on Rotten Tomatoes, and yet we've won 26 awards and some really good film festivals and been on Delta and blah, blah, blah. How the heck did that happen?
So it was an excruciating process, which literally only just finished like a couple of weeks ago. But starting in December of last year, myself and my partner, one of our producing partners, David Bond, first of all, we bought lists of critics, you know, from all.
I didn't know you could do that. Where can you do that?
No, it exists. You can buy, you know, lists of the publicity stuff that you can reach out to and stuff like that. But then also, it literally went into Rotten Tomatoes. And they have a list alphabetically of all the tomato approved critics. And I literally went one name at a time. It's like, I don't know, something like 2000 or so. And Googled and found all the contact emails for all of them. And then I just pitched it. I just said, hey, this is our film, blah, blah, blah. This is the trailer. We'd love it if you'd be open to doing a review. That's how it happened. So all the reviews we've gotten have basically been through that. But then also we have a piece that's about the IndieWire came to us during that process after they started discovering it. And then they did a piece on Tom and I, not too long ago. The New York Post is about to do a big spread on us, sometime in the next week or so. I don't even know how that came about actually, but it just started getting out there. People started hearing about the project. And then, and then there's some other big, big publication reviews that are coming soon too, that I don't want to say what on the off chance I jinx it.
That is just amazing. So, congratulations on those. Thank you for the little insight into maybe trying that ourselves and showing us how you can independently, you know, go out there and find your own publicity, because that's hard for us filmmakers to know how to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just have to get really creative and stuff, and you might think, oh, don't do, and don't get me wrong. There are people or a handful of people who are like, you know, what are you doing? Sending me a message, that kind of thing. Talk to my agent. But again, it's all about, you know, if you're a filmmaker, you just have to get used to rejection. You know, that's just the story of, or not even just filmmaker, anyone in the arts. It's all about finding a way to suck it up and know that not to take rejection personally, even if they sometimes, you know, there's assholes out there that are cruel and say horrible things to you, but you have to just be like, know that there are a million of people who've had that same experience, and if they can get through it, you can get through it too. So you just have to persevere. It's not for everybody. It's a
great word.
Yeah.
Well, we're about to lose Tom, and I want to give him, you know, a few minutes here. Tom, you have loved movies since your childhood. You know, now here you are an executive producer and in the film. What have you learned now that you are on the inside, as they say? That's question number one. And question number two, what has been your favorite part of this whole process?
You know, I've learned a lot of, I've never done a film before. So everything that we're doing, I was learning.
It's not true. You did that film as a kid.
That's true.
You know what? I'll tell you what I was impressed with and what I learned is how hard these people work. So Juan Reynoso and his film crew, and I was with them as we traveled around. These are long days. They are not easy days. The filming was fun. I really enjoyed the filming. It was just natural for me, and I really had fun with it. But you know, the time it takes to set up and travel from one state to the next with all that equipment and check into your hotel room. I mean, you know, we'd meet in the lobby at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going to bed in a new city that night at nine, you know, going into my room at 9 o'clock, you know? So they are long days they're such hard workers, the film crew was, and Juan, and they had a good attitudes the entire time. So one of my favorite things about it, honestly, you'd say, well, maybe it was all the props you saw. And that's true. And I loved meeting those people, but it was also just the camaraderie we had traveling around to Europe and in the United States with the film crew. I mean, just the laughs we had and I don't know. I'm a big camaraderie culture person, and we had a good crew.
Yeah. That's awesome. Some favorite memories?
You know, well, besides hanging out with the crew and the laughs we had, I would have to say my favorite memory was probably interviewing Robert Englund. And then also realizing how great Lance Henriksen was to interview. He's a gentleman. He's just a funny guy. Reminds me of my mom.
Tell everybody then, who this is.
And Gillis was great too. I mean, I was really impressed with those interviewees. I would say that Luca, the guy from Arezzo, Italy, was probably one of my favorite. They were all great. Everybody we interviewed was great. He was just a ball of energy and fun though.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing your passion with the world in Mad Props. I loved meeting you. You made me love, you know, the whole prop industry. You made a very solid argument, both of you did, for this whole prop thing being a work of art. And that was a large argument that you were making from the very beginning of the film, that this just isn't some, you know, stupid, crazy stuff that people are doing, but that this is an art form that's slowly being recognized as real art. And I think as we saw things through your eyes, you began to convince me. You made a good argument. And so thank you for sharing that passion with me. I enjoyed it.
I'm so glad you did. And I'll tell you, one of the nicest things, you can talk about art in all different ways, from price to rarity. But to me, it's the smile I get from people. I mean, if I can make people smile, that is a good day, and or make people feel good or evoke emotion. And whenever I show them a prop, you get this instant smile on your face, and they immediately go back to, I love that movie. I mean, all the chemicals in your brain are hitting or firing at that moment. And I'm able to do that for somebody else and they enjoy it. And that's what makes this collection and collecting movie props so wonderful, if you ask me.
Yeah. Well, but thanks
for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Super nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
I will leave you to it.
Yeah. We'll see you later. Bye, Tom.
Okay. Piggybacking on what Tom was just saying too about crew and stuff is that's just sort of the mentality. You know, because, and I guess anybody, like I started out like anybody else too, right? When I was a teenager, it was just like a, or young adult or whatever. It was as a PA, right? And it made my way up the ladder. You meet, you know, so many people out there who are just miserable, you know, and so unhappy. And from a get-go, you know, I was raised just like Tom, right, to be optimistic and learn how to deal with the highs and lows of life. And so it's something that I've always applied to my professional career too. It's just like, and the fact that I got to be, you know, I've been doing this my entire career and it's basically all I've ever done. And I've had I've made a living at it my entire life. And so it's like, I don't take that for granted. And so, I know how fortunate I am to have had a career and stuff like that, that I like to make sure that other people feel that as well. Like you only, you know, you set the tone, right? And so these miserable people who make sets so unhappy to be around, why would you want to do that to yourself? Yeah. It's one thing to get to do certain things from time to time, and you don't always have that choice when you're first starting out, obviously, but you need to learn quickly you need to set the standard that you really want to see on projects and stuff like that. So I was known even before I was in the position of authority as that guy, and I sometimes wouldn't get rehired as I was coming up because people thought I was I'd literally complaints where he's too, excuse my language, but he's too fucking happy. And I'm just like, well, you know what? That's ridiculous. Then I don't want to work for that person. That's ridiculous. Yeah. It didn't matter that my work was flawless. They just couldn't stand that I was so happy. So I was like, well, you know what? Then they're not worth working for. So I try to make sure that that comes across and stuff like that. And that was also Tom, by the way, because like, and he, the second he saw, he brought it up like very early on. He's like, God, I had no idea how hard you guys were. He's like, I don't think I work anywhere near as hard as you guys
do.
And he's like, I had no idea. And I was like, yeah, dude, it's hard work, you know, and it's because it can be exhausting. But when you add all that in, it's just like, why would I want to be on a project that is so hard and exhausting if I'm not also just having a blast? And so I always try to make sure that as my career went on, I always made mental note of the people who I knew on top of creative talent, who I wanted to have work on my projects when I finally had that say, you know? And so that's all I do now is just like, I work with a lot of the same people, and then any new people that come up and stuff, I make sure that they come from people who have the same attitude I do, because then I know that those people are going to have the same attitude. So that's just saying, because the more fun everyone is having, so you have to get the work done. I'm not saying don't be frivolous and ridiculous and goof around and not get the job done. But as long as the job is getting done, there's zero reason for us not to have a blast and enjoy one another and just marvel at the fact that, geez, man, look at what we get to do for a living. It's like we're super hashtag blessed, right? So it's just like, yeah, I insist that be something that be reflected upon everything I do, you know. And I hope other people do that too. You know, I think that's some of my advice to people who are just starting out stuff.
That's beautiful, a beautiful word. And I think you said a key thing there. You know, they need to be proficient, but I also want them to be, you know, pleasant on set. I would also say I almost prioritize as a director, producer, that person who's pleasant on set, has a great demeanor, helpful, willing to do whatever, go the extra mile, but maybe not be as skilled as this other person over here.
100, yeah.
Because I can train this person. You know, if they have that attitude and that outlook, they are going to want to learn. That's part of their personality. And so I always, you know, prioritize that disposition of a person. And I too try to make my sets that way. My mentality has always been life is too short.
Yeah.
And it's really not about the end product. We're telling stories that we hope change the lives of people, right? We want them to be blessed. We want their lives to be better. We want to improve the world around us, right? And so if we do that, then we need to do that in our crew as well, mm-hmm. on our sets as well, because these places, these little communities that we're making, it's really how we treat people. It's, you know, it's who we become. And I think that's almost more important sometimes than the work product, because if it is a healthy environment, if we're treating people well, if we're respecting boundaries, it's going to show in the work product in the end.
Yeah. And it just makes people even want to work harder.
Yeah. I think so.
Because they love coming to work, you know? And then like there's something I don't actually really talk about much in all these interviews I've been doing is, during the first leg of filming in the US, I actually had an incident where I almost died. And so I had to be hospitalized for a week. And we had to pause filming because I was in a hospital. And I had an acute renal thrombosis, which, you know, whatever. Look at
that. That does not sound fun.
It was not fun. And if it's one of those rare things that if it's not diagnosed, like 95% of the people who have it, it's a very rare condition, die. Ugh. Because no one thinks to check for it. And I was super lucky. They did check for it. Anyway, I remember I was in the process and the amount of pain and all this stuff. And I was in the emergency room and I, as much as it was hurting and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening in the middle of the shoot. In the back of my head, I also thought, but man, what a way to go that the last thing I did was so much fun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just like, it would suck to go to die, but man, I'm dying on a high. So that was great.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that story and that perspective. I do think it's really important for people to hear what you're saying. You've been in this industry a really long time and you've got, you know, some really excellent work product out there and you've learned a lot of lessons. And I think that's important. I mean, when you think back to the days where you were scrapping, trying to make it, eating ramen noodles, you know, how did you get to a place where you could survive and pay your bills and, you know, talk a little bit about that journey?
I mean, you know, you have to suck it up. When I was just a PA and stuff, I guess it was, again, I'm one of the rare people that pretty much, you know, it's not like I had to do like a years of waiting tables like so many other people and stuff like that, right? So I was very fortunate that I got invited to do a thing, a PA on a movie that never came out. But then I, as I started working and working more and more, you know, you have roommates. Obviously this is in New York, right? So it was like, you know, I had roommates and all that jazz to help make ends meet. And yes, you're right. You know, it's ramen and, you know, the cheap stuff. And there are times where you don't, you know, your meal, your best meals come from set, you know, so.
Right.
So
thank goodness for craft service.
No, you're like, oh, God, thank God. It's just about trying to be smart and budgeting things properly and, you know, don't spend what you don't have. It's kind of as easier said than done, honestly, but it is really as simple as that, you know, just don't spend what you don't have. A lot of it is like work ethic, you know, like if you're going like, this is a thing that, man, I got to tell you nowadays too, I hate firing people, but I've had to fire people because they come out of, like, you know, film school acting like all entitled. And I know I'm this, I'm better than this. I don't have to do this. And it's like, I've had to be in situations where I've fired people because they wouldn't even PAs because they wouldn't, you know, I treat everyone equally. You know, I don't put anyone down, but like, you're a PA. Sometimes you gotta fill the cooler. You gotta put the ice, refill the ice. I mean, the grunt work is, you know, all this stuff has a reason for happening. And the thing is I always reward the PAs and PAs who, I mean, you know, I'm not gonna say who, but there's a PA, for instance, who I got started in the business or when he first started out. And now he's the CEO and founder of one of the biggest post and visual effects companies in the world. And he always credits me for that stuff. Because the thing is you show up and you're entitled. There's no room for that. Like, if I see that you're working your butt off, which is what I did, you know, I was always sweating because I was always going out of my way to make sure I was getting everything done that needed to get done. But then, you know, and this is something I learned, is that the people who saw that and saw my work ethic rewarded me by being like, well, hey, what department do you want to, what are you most interested in? What do you want to be? You know, and then that's how I started getting put with the, you know, in production and stuff like that. And I moved up the ladder very quickly as a result, because they knew I had the work ethic, and that's the same. And I do the same thing now. So if I've had PAs who are career PAs, right? And that's fine. Then they still do the work and that's all they're really interested in. But then you got the ones who are very curious and they understand that there is a political hierarchy. It's just like there isn't anything. But if you work hard and you let it be known without being super pushy what you're interested in doing, the producers that are worth working for are the ones that are going to be like, okay, I'm going to, you know what? As soon as you're done with that, go hang out with so-and-so so you can start learning, you know? Mm. And then that's how you start networking and all that jazz. And, you know, and that's how, over the years I amassed, and that's how I was able to like when I, my first short films, how I was able to, you know, keep costs down and people did me favors for free that were pros in the business because they knew how hard I worked and they believed in me and et cetera, et cetera. And that's all part of that process. If you hadn't behaved a certain way, you know, you're not going to get the assistance that you need, as you progress and do the things that you really want to do and stuff. It all feeds right into each other. Mm-hmm. So it's a process. So I was very lucky. I got, you know, it took a while to break out of commercials because commercials
pay.
It paid so well. And so that was a risk. And you take a financial risk anytime you switch gears. So like, you know, when I transitioned, because I was an AD for a long time, and I was, you know, when I went from PAing into second ADing and then first ADing, and then my late wife was like, finally, she's like, dude, you need to focus on directing. And so I was like, okay. And so I finally, because she's like, that's what I've always really wanted, right? And so like, then I finally started sucking it up. And every time you make that switch, it's hard because you're kind of like, it is a reputational thing, is people only know you for, it's just kind of like acting, right? If you're, you know, you get pigeonholed into playing these kinds of roles or et cetera, right? So it's like, you need to start, unfortunately, saying
turning
no.
Turning down, right. Saying yeah. No, I'm not a first AD. I'm sorry. I'm a director. Yeah.
And then you also, you know, you make sure you're, there are the producers out there where some of those producers who were supportive of you, period, and helping you learn and grow, they're also going to be the ones that you can say to, hey, listen, I'm not looking, I want to stop doing this and only focus on this. Do you think you could help push me or connect me to that thing so I can, and they will like, sometimes some of them will just be like, nope, you're done. I'm not calling you anymore. And then the others will be like, oh my God, yes, absolutely. And they start giving you those chances and stuff. So sometimes, you know, there'll be like a few months here and there that are super lean and painful because you can't, you're late on rent. You're, of course, you know, everybody, you know, that happened a lot. But it's just something you have to believe in yourself for. And then if for whatever reason it's still not happening, then you have to go back slightly. It's fine. I mean, don't beat yourself up over it. You know, that's just like one of those things that you just have to keep going and going and going. And when the time is right, you know, hopefully it'll happen, you know, but
yeah, it's never quitting. I mean, Ken Burns says that. I quote him all the time on this podcast. It's complete perseverance and belief and fortitude and faith. And it's all of those things wrapped into one. And, you know, if you're meant to do this, those are the qualities you have to have. And if you have them, eventually, if you're focused on relationships and serving others and, you know, working your craft, those things will all come together. When you think of yourself now, I mean, you're so versatile and you have so many things in your past. When you think of yourself, how do you think of yourself now? What is the, how would you describe yourself primarily? Director, producer, just filmmaker?
Well, I mean, I always just say writer, producer, director, right? But I guess, you know, filmmaker is just like the catch-all. I mean, I like all things equally. Like, so theirs, our next project, which should be start shooting in June. I wrote
it. Sounds amazing. What's the log line for that?
After a lifetime of abuse at the hands of men throughout her life, a woman with the help of her teenage daughter finally finds her independence and breaks free from the abuse and purchases her first house, only to find there are malicious secrets hiding within the walls.
So is that a horror?
It's a supernatural. Yeah. I mean, it's, I guess technically it's a horror, but we call it a supernatural thriller.
Okay.
So it's a cool thing.
And Rita Moreno, is she the woman? Is she the star?
No. So she's a supporting cast member, but, and I don't want to give too much away because there are a lot of twists and turns. So if I give too much away, it's like,
that's okay. We don't want to do
Sanchez.
That.
She's the woman. She's the lead.
Okay.
And then everyone else, they're all the supporting characters. Anyway, it was a nightmare that I had. And that's how that script
a real one.
Yeah. So I had this nightmare and then I literally woke up and wrote it. The script came together so fast. I knew when I wrote it, I was like, if you look back at all my previous, like, and especially on all my shorts and stuff like that, the majority of my scripts the theme is essentially about some kind of female empowerment. I guess it's because I'm a mama's boy, but it's always been about some sort of female empowerment. So the cast have either been primarily women, or the story revolved around a woman, or like there's one that's literally just two men in the entire film, but the entire story is about a woman who'd been wronged. So it's just like, that's just something that I've always been, I don't know. This is always what happens. Right. So coincidentally, this one, I was like, you know what? Again, it was female driven. And I thought to myself, I don't think I should direct this. I feel like this should be a woman director. And sometimes it's hard for writers to let go and be like, no, I have to direct. It was just natural for me. I was just like, no, this has to be a female. And so there was a female director that I always found super interesting through another producer friend of mine. And so she had actually started exploding not just last year. She had two back-to-back films with Lionsgate and had Stephen Lang and Bruce Dern and like some really great actors in her films. And I was like, all right, I'm going to pitch it to her, see what she thinks. And then it was just such a natural fit. And we also just became fast friends, and she's so crazy talented. But anyway, so she's directing that. So it's just kind of basically knowing, I think you'll know what's right and what's not, you know, 'cause then the one right after that is one I wrote, That's a horror comedy. Horror was accidental, and I'll get into that. But it's a horror comedy where the comedy is informed by the. It's a reactionary comedy, so they're it's in the moment they're reacting to the horror. Because, you know, sometimes it's like when you get scared by something and you're like, oh my, and you start laughing at yourself because you're like, that was stupid. Why was I so scared? It's kind of like that sort of thing.
Okay.
Except the things that are in the movie that you would
they be, really, you should be scared?
Yeah, you should be scared. Yeah. but the reactions are just hilarious at the same time. So that's kind of how it's informed. But that one was one where I knew it, like, when I wrote the script, it was like, I didn't write the traditional script. I literally wrote it as a shooting script. So I was writing it cut to this shot, to this shot, to this shot. That's how it came out of me. So I knew that I had to direct this one, even though the two leads are female.
Yeah.
I was like, no, this one's you were
seeing it with the director's mind.
Too much of it. Yeah. It was like ingrained in me. So I was like, I had to do that. And then the one after that is actually is Whirlwind. And this is more, you know, for up and coming filmmakers and stuff like that too, to think about. Is like, I get that I want to do, and some people are super fortunate, right? That their first one, and they're called this auteur because it was such a beautiful first film, et cetera. And that's great. But that doesn't happen all the time, you know, and that's not realistic. So I knew my favorite things are period pieces. I love epic period.
They're my favorite. Do you like Queen? Do you like Queen's Gambit?
Yes. No. So just about anything that's period, I love.
I know. Me too.
But the thing is those are like the so notoriously expensive and don't make money.
They don't make money.
Like, yeah. So it's like I said, okay. Well, you know what? I'm gonna do. I know horror is like the most successful genre and most the best selling genre worldwide. So I was like, I'm going to do horror. And then I coincidentally met a very well-known producer in the horror genre and we became friends. And that's how that started, so that I could do these horrors. And then people would be like, okay, well, no, he's got the track record now, so then maybe we can let him do something that he really wants to do, right? So then the project after Crybaby Hill is going to be a Western that takes place in 1851. And so
those are in right now, thanks to Yellowstone.
And that's just a coincidence too. Like I wrote it.
The meat of it's a good thing.
Yeah. No, it's great. Yeah. Cause it's the hot commodity right now. Right.
So yeah.
And that also helped. So sometimes it's timing. Things just like
fall
into place. It's just
wow. Well, you know, you kind of light up when you're talking about these narrative projects. So do you really feel like you? Yeah. I can tell you're really lighting up.
I love documentaries too. Like, you know, like some docs that popped in my head right now, or like. There's a doc that I saw a long time ago.
Okay, wait, hold on. We're going to move into our favorite segment, DocuView Deja Vu.
Oh,
all right, yes. Now, go ahead. Now you can tell us your favorite docs.
So, yeah, no, I never set out to make docs necessarily, but I've always loved docs, and I love documentaries and doc series and stuff like that. But, like, Dear Zachary was a movie that came out several years ago.
This one, but I don't think I saw it.
So, oh my God, so heartbreaking and so upsetting.
Now I don't want to watch it.
but it's beautiful too, but it deals with mental illness and stuff. And it's, but it's a very beautiful film. You know, obviously the most recently when it just won the Oscar was 20 Days in Mariupol, which was just unbelievable.
I haven't seen that either. Can you give me the, you know, short synopsis?
It's basically this crew that basically were able to, they were basically right when the war started, when Russia invaded Ukraine, and they captured like that the first 20 or so days, and you know, showcase first responders and the people that. Everything that they were going through and that first thing, and you know, and how everyone thought that they were going to instantly just get decimated, right? But then they now we're two years in, So it's a beautiful, beautiful film, about, you know, the human spirit, right? And then another one, classic, that is, I mean, there's so many, right? But one that was interesting was I always mention is Capturing the Freedmans, because capturing in that one, I believe that won the best doc Oscar as well.
I never saw that one either.
Or at least was nominated, but I'm pretty sure it won. But it was this guy who originally, he had set out to make a documentary about a family member who did clown shows for kids parties and stuff like that, right?
Okay.
And that was the original thing. But then as they were filming, they discovered this horrific history of sexual abuse and child molestation in the family. And then it just became like, obviously it didn't,
it totally went sideways. Like we were talking about earlier,
The
documentary that was going to be about clowns and all of a sudden became about something else.
Yeah. And it was, it's a very, and again, it's also upsetting, but, it's an example about how sometimes, you know, documentaries, especially doesn't always come out in the process as the way you originally intended.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of also, I mean, granted, not the subject matter is horrible, obviously, but it's kind of the nice, kind of why I like doing things organically too, is because you never know what's going to happen.
Right. I love that too.
You have to be prepared, right, to go with the flow and go for that. And so that's like a prime example of a story like that. Anyway.
So I have, I'm so sorry for taking so much of your time, but this has just been fascinating. And I'm just so humbled that you would share this expertise with us, and so thankful. I do have two more questions and then I'll cut you free. The first question is, we talked about what you learned early on in your career, you know, the things about how to make it. You've been doing this for a long time. How many years would you say you've been at this?
Not counting when I like started as an actor, right, in theater when I was a little kid. So in terms of writer, producer, director, professional.
Yeah, like, yeah. You know, making money to survive.
Since I was 18. So that's okay. 30 years now.
Okay, 30 years. What are you learning now that's new? Like, you know, in the last, I would say, 6 months or a year, what's the new stuff that you're like just learning?
Oh.
Because, you know, we are always learning as filmmakers.
You are. And the thing is you always have to be, I think, to be an interesting human being is you always have to be willing to learn new things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing worse than a know-it-all, right? So being open to learning new things is always important, right? I mean, you know, I don't know. That's a tough question. Like,
all right, I'm going to give you time to think about that in the back of your brain, because I threw that at you without any, you know, preparation. So this one I prepared you for. When I was looking at Mad Props, I was blown away by a lot of material that I was like, wow, how did they get all of this? Movie clips, for example, and just so much stuff that I know was fair use. A lot of people don't understand fair use. So can you talk to us about what was fair use in your film? What is fair use? And educate us about that a little bit.
Sure. You know, and I always knew a bit about what fair use was, but not to the extent that I did learn on this one, right? So there was what we did is as we discovered everyone. So we knew going into the collectors we were going to film, they did send in advance sort of a summary of their props. And so when we got in there, we knew we had an idea of what we may focus on, but again, we also allowed it to go whichever way it went. And then whatever props we spoke about in detail, as I was writing the script, I'm like, all right, well, this would be a great place to do a clip from this. So you can reference, you know, it's, especially because those are, you know, the cinephiles are going to know what that prop's from, right? They don't need to see the clip to know, but you want that there so you can draw in general audiences as well, who might not know that film, and they see, oh, wait, no, I do remember that, blah, blah, blah. So then we would just make a laundry list of all the clips that we would love to feature. And then as the script got whittled down, you know, the clips got whittled down, and then you didn't want, the movie is not about film clips, right? So it's, you also needed to,
you were just trying to show the props in context.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. And so you had to, like, you know, start getting really honed in and not go overboard. So then, you have to, so fair use basically has to do a lot with, the shortened version of it is that you, fair use means that you're only using like a certain number of seconds or so.
And what is the seconds? Is it like 13 seconds?
Well, no. I mean, I think on average it's like 10 is like a safe number, but they, you know, we actually also hired our clearance attorneys, are like the best in the industry.
Okay. Who are they? Why don't we recommend them?
Donaldson, Califf, and, Perez.
Okay.
They're in LA. Right. And so they're like the best clearance, attorneys in the industry. And so we use them, and by the way, it's not as expensive as you would think. Not that it's not expensive, but it is, but it's not. And so they basically, we broke down every single scene where there were clips and stuff like that, and we listed everything. You had to basically list how long the clip that you're going to use is, what it was referencing, you know, blah, 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 the in, out, blah, blah. And so it's this whole spreadsheet, which is like a, you know, a pain in the butt, but you know, it's necessary. And that's another thing too. It's like, I know everyone thinks it looks expensive, the whole film, but you got to remember that 90% of all of that I did. So we couldn't afford to have people do that, you know, like, specific job is to list all these things and stuff. I had to do it. So it was just like a lot. But anyway, they go through and then they research and they watch the film as well. And then they say, if it has a clear, the usage of that clip has a clear purpose, as a sort of a reference to something in the film itself, in your film, and it's not used as a way for you to make money off of. So I'm not putting the clip in there so that I can make money off of that movie. You know what I mean? So as long as that's very clear, then it falls within fair use practices and stuff.
So for example,
you are allowed to have that clip for free, and it's justifiable that you're not using it as a means to make more money off of them.
So to give an example, that Tom used earlier, he referenced the Indiana Jones whip. Mm-hmm. So you used a clip from Indiana Jones that just showed the clip being used, or also the Holy Grail. There's a clip in there of Indiana Jones going for the Holy Grail with Sean Connery and Harrison Ford, and you show that clip. In that example, it is a very short clip. It's focused exactly on the prop, and it's just to demonstrate the prop that the person is holding in their hand or talking about.
Right. And so it's kind of like, think of it as your term paper, right? When you're growing up and you had to do papers, right? Write term papers. It's basically that you have to, like, you're referencing, you're using an example. And what keeps it from being plagiarism is you're using the example to help support.
You're citing it. You're basically citing an example. Yeah,
exactly. And you're using that to support your point. And then at the end of the paper, you list all those citations, right? So that's the same deal. And so we made sure that this particular, the use of the whip, it was to show, look, we focused on the whip that he owns in the movie. We show this as a reinforcement of where it came from and all that as a supporting factor to that. And then in the end credits, we listed every single clip and then also like who the director was, who the production company was, who owns the rights to that clip. Right. And so you gave them their recognition for it. So,
well, so I got to ask you, you know, you do have these clips in there. We've talked about fair use. How did you actually get those clips? What is the process? If I was going to use them in my film, what would I do?
Yeah. So you want to work, with the attorneys that you're working with too, and they'll generally, they should guide you to the right way to do it and whether or not one approach is better than another. But like a traditional way to do it would be to actually reach out to the studios or whoever it is that owns the copyright to that film and then state what you're using it for and the clip, and they should be able to give you a form letter basically that you would send out to those people requesting it and what it is specifically you're using, and hope that they get back to you in a timely manner and stuff. Otherwise your legal team should be able to tell you like an efficient way to go about it and stuff. Sometimes they won't, you know, they won't get back to you. So it's just like it's kind of a nightmare. So it's a process. It is a process. So
I found that same trouble with getting music rights. Getting music rights was a nightmare as well. I mean, I did it myself. I didn't have anybody else do it. Trying to chase down old music, who knows who has the rights, getting people to respond to you. It was terrible, but yes, you have to stick to it. And sometimes you have to figure ways around to solve your problem. So thank you for that. Okay. We're going to go back to that last question. Maybe you've had some time to think about it. Maybe not, which is what are you learning now?
I mean, I guess what I'm learning now is that it's something that I always knew anyway, is that I don't know everything. And what's cool about what we do for a living is that, it's even more so now than it was 25 years ago. Right. Like, so, you know, when I first started out, there weren't, you know, cell phones, there weren't all these other means of communication. When you're doing pickups and stuff for jobs, when you're a PA and stuff, you literally had to go find a payphone to check in with production and stuff like that. And that wasn't even that long ago, you know? So nowadays it's like month to month, there's some new technological advancement that makes what was the hip thing last month obsolete already. So it's like crazy.
It's almost week to week now.
I know. Right. So it's just
even in the industry, for example, I mean, not 6 months ago, it was nobody is licensing independent, you know, films. Forget about it. I mean, only Netflix and Amazon, they're only doing their own stuff. They're not licensing anybody's stuff. Well, then the next thing, you know, Netflix has said, well, I think we're going to license people's stuff now.
Oh my God. They flip back and forth. It's just like, it's crazy. Right. So you have to like, some things are kind of like the same or, you know, in terms of how it's approached and everything. And maybe there's like small changes to that. And that's kind of traditional how it always goes. Right. But, I think I'm constantly learning. I learned that you have to continually be learning and absorbing as much new information as you possibly can. And know that for every thing that you think is the case, chances are that within very shortly that's going to change. And you know that because you read that such and such is on the horizon, right?
Right.
So it's just like streaming. It's just like you knew that there seemed to be that there was only like a certain number of streamers out there, right? But then before you know it, there are like 100 more places. Right. So what seemed like a shut door for you to be able to get your content out there last week suddenly there's 20 more doors that as options that you can get to, right? And so, like, for instance, like you dream of getting your project to live to be licensed to a Netflix or a Hulu after you've done your TVOD, right? Your rental and purchase, digital rental and purchases online, which is kind of easy to do, right? It's kind of easy to get them on all the platforms in that form, but we're still, like, for instance, they're still negotiating the licensing deal for the end of April for when we will hopefully have a permanent or a semi-permanent home on a subscription service like Netflix or Hulu or Max. Know that even if you can't get that route to get your movie out there, that there are always new distribution models coming up.
And I will say it's not over. Like you were saying, like right now, your upcoming release, first of all, you already had a theatrical release, which is amazing. You know, your movie's released theatrically, but you have a release coming, limited release. You have it coming out on March 26th, right? Where's it going to debut on March 26th?
Every major platform, you know, all of them, Apple, Roku, Prime, you know. Everywhere you can rent and buy movies on your smart TV or online, that's where you'll see it.
And then they're still pitching it to the bigger players. Yeah. And they're still doing that with my film, which came out 2 years ago, because guess what? All the people at those places are totally new. Everybody else was gone who's never heard the pitches. And of course, our film came out in COVID, so that was a terrible time for a film to come out anyway. But it's never over until it's over, really. And exactly. it's really never over. So that what we're saying is don't lose hope. If your film is out there and you haven't been able to get distribution, don't lose hope. And I would certainly say, let us connect you to Joe Amodei at Virgil Films, because he will look at any film. He loves films.
Such great guys, man.
Tremendous guys. Joe and Tim Amagiani, who is just right up there with him. Let us know.
Yeah. And they, I was going to say something else about that. About your getting your
it's never over till it's over, I said.
Yeah, no, God, it had to do with that and stuff. Yeah,
don't ever quit, we were saying.
It must not have been super profound.
It'll come to you for sure.
Yeah, no, but you just can't give up, because, you know, there's always a way it's going to, oh, that's what it was. So you also keep in mind that you have to look at a lot of those little things, right? Like sometimes some people will just be like, all right, I'm going to put my film out there. Like I could have just given it. And this is something that Joe and Tim at Virgil were like, even they were like, can't believe what you've gotten accomplished. On top of it, it's just like, don't just even though they're amazing guys and they work their butts off, don't just rely and just assume everyone else is going to do the work for me and it's just going to magically become successful now, because it does not work that way.
No, so it doesn't.
Tim and Joe weren't like, hey, you got to do this. They're like, we're going to do, they do a certain amount of publicity themselves. Right. And then I knew, you know what, if I really wanted to get it even bigger, I got to do this work. And then that's when I did the thing where I went through found every single critic and whatnot, because I knew the more I could get positive reviews or just reviews in general. Cause sometimes people watch, I do this. Sometimes I'll watch a movie I discover on late at night in bed. I'll pick a movie because the reviews are so bad. I'm like, I gotta see why this movie's so bad. and then sometimes I'll be like, yes, it was a terrible movie, but holy crap, I really enjoyed it. It's so bad, it's good. But anyway, but you need to do that extra work. So I didn't go into this thinking, oh my God, I have I know my movie is going to be 100% fresh. I'm still blown away that it is. I'm expecting the next review to be like, yo, these guys suck. But I've just been super fortunate. But none of that would have happened if I hadn't done that excruciatingly mind-numbing, and it is mind-numbing.
Yeah.
But if I hadn't done it, we wouldn't be in this position. And now we can be like, hey, by the way, we can use that as a marketing technique now. We just think, by the way, 100% freshness. And you're like, oh my goodness, that helps sell. That helps push your movie along. And that's something that Joe and Tim like said, you're like, can't believe you got all these amazing, you went out and found these reviewers and stuff. This is so helpful. So you have to, yes. So they're the teachers, they're the experienced people out there that are helping, you know, your kid grow and whatnot, but you're always going to be the parent of your product. So don't just assume I'm going to throw my kid out into the world and whatever happens, happens, you know, because sometimes it's just nothing happens. And so you really want to stay with them and kind of help continue making it grow as much as you're able to. So
it is a great, great point. I mean, Joe and Tim work their butts off and they never quit. It is the same. The story is true for me. We also on our end have worked very hard to get our film on Delta, very hard to get our film on United, very hard to get our film have this theatrical release this summer. We have not quit. And then I would keep going back to Joe and say, can you pitch it here? Can you pitch it there? Are you sure you can't do this? And in doing that, they ended up pitching it to Canal Plus. We don't even have an international deal with them, but I said, can you please just try? They did. And Canal Plus picked it up and it's going to be in every French nation in the world.
That makes total sense because of the subject matter, you know, and, and all that stuff. Of course.
And so that is because I know I'm its parent. It's my kid. It's my responsibility. And the day is different now. You can't just hand it over to somebody else and expect, you know, your child to develop and grow.
And it's even harder for you because your film is more of a niche.
Oh, no kidding.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas mine, the whole point is like the very last line of the movie is everybody loves a good movie. So it's just like, yeah, if you like movies, there's a 90% likelihood that you're going to love this movie because everybody loves movies.
Well, right? And I'll tell you why else people like your movie. It's so appealing. And I've found all of these movies appealing. You have a window into a subset of the world that most people do not have eyes into. And you are exposing the subset of the world that is fascinating. Fascinating to learn that there's this whole world you never knew about, and there's all of these incredibly passionate people, and yet they're wonderful and interesting, and it isn't just about money. It's about a whole bunch of other things that are a lot deeper than that.
If Tom hadn't brought this to me, I never would have thought to do this. You know what I mean? So, he likes to tell everybody that, and that's fine, and I appreciate it, but he's like, Juan did 98% of the work. But the thing is, that's fine, and I appreciate it, but if he hadn't brought it to me, I wouldn't have had the chance to do that work. So it's because of his own passion as well and whatnot. It just all was like this perfect confluence of events and emotions and everything that just tied together just so perfectly, you know, that doesn't always happen. So no. I'm super fortunate and it started with him. So Tom gets a lot of the credit. He's such an amazing, human being. And
I could tell.
And that was one of those things that I wish I could have put even more of in there. But it's one of those dangers where you're like, you don't want to do too much because it's not just about Tom. It's about the community and the people and all of our connection to movies as an art form and stuff. But he's just such an amazing human being, but we couldn't focus on all the, he's crazy. He downplays the philanthropy and stuff, but he does so much philanthropy work. And
that's beautiful.
He gives so much of himself away to others. And is one of the most selfless people I've ever known. in my life. And he goes, here's a fun story about him. I don't know if he's going to be mad at me, but no one has ever done this. Is in my entire career, I was floored by it when we, our very first, and he did this throughout. But like when we did our first round of filming, which took place in Jackson Hole, that was the very first sequences we shot. At the end of the shoot, when we were getting ready to leave Jackson Hole, all of a sudden he pulls out money and hands extra money to each of the crew members. Aww. And we're like, what is this? And he's like, oh my God, dude, I'm so thankful for everything you've done. And I can't believe the work. I had no idea. And I just wanted to just do this as like another extra thing. I was like, see, he literally tipped us and tipped us well. And so it was just kind of like, I told him, I was like, Tom, nobody has, I don't think anybody in the history of cinema has ever done this.
No.
That's the kind of human being he is. You know what I mean?
That's so beautiful.
He doesn't take his, and not for nothing. He is a hard worker himself and he's smart and, you know, he may be super successful, but you know what? He didn't rest on his laurels to get that. He worked his ass off to get where he is. And he also, there's a lot of moments in the film that, or in the shooting that, in the filming that didn't make it the film. But when you see his family who are just also just endearing people, and I've known most of them my whole life as well, except for, well, I've been in New York, right? But they're lovely people, but there's some wonderful moments between him and his son that didn't make it into the film where he actually, you know, he's teaching him about the value of giving back and not just, and yes, he does this and he does spend money because he has the ability to do so. But for everything you do, that's for yourself and stuff, you should do 10 times that for other people. So it's like it's an important life lessons and stuff. So, you know, I think for the most part, you don't see him because you can tell what a great person he is. You tend to just not think about the fact that, you know, oh, is this only something that rich people can do? Because he seems and comes, not seems, because he is clearly a very genuine human being. But there were stuff that didn't make it into the film that supported that fact even more so. How he instills these values into his own children and the rest of his family is the same way, and how they're just incredibly giving people, you know? And he's just one of the greatest. Yeah, honestly, he's hands down one of the best human beings I've ever known in my life.
Well, you know what? You may not have explicitly put it in there. I knew that already, and you know how I knew it.
No, I said.
What you did put in there is I saw how his family looked at him. I saw the loving looks they gave him. They never once made fun of him for collecting. In a sense, they looked up to him. And, you know, they were part of his... he brought them along on their journey. So in a sense, they were all discovering the wonder and the majesty together. It wasn't like something he was doing selfishly that he was taking away from his family. He was sharing that joy with all of them and they were along for it all. And what's so beautiful is that when I first met Tom, you weren't there yet. I talked about my favorite parts of it were with Rocco, his son, because you could see the love and the adoration that his son had for him. And you could see how he did not separate his work or his play from his family at all. And you can see that in how he just lives with them and how he passes on who he is and what he does with his family. So you may not have put that in there explicitly, but I got all that from what you did put in there.
Good. I'm glad, because that was important to me. and he was a little self-conscious about it. He's like, God, I really hope I don't come across like some sort of, you know, wealthy asshole or something like that. I'm like, trust me, Tom.
He's wealthy. Clearly, you can't spend those things without having the money to do it. But he did not come across that way at all. And
you don't even think about it.
So anyway, I've kept you far too long. This has been a beautiful conversation. Thank you for your generosity of spirit. Thank you for making a beautiful piece of work that I really enjoyed. It lifted my spirits. And I hope people will enjoy the wisdom that you've had to share today. And I do hope someday I'll have you back on the show.
Yeah, please. Yeah. Anytime. And I got to go check out your movie now too.
Oh, well, I will give you the link and I would love for you to watch it.
Yeah. Cause I've been so busy that I, you know, like I said, I fail to read thoroughly everything. So
it's
now
okay.
That I know about your film, I got to make time to,
that blesses
to
me.
Check it out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, don't hang up. I'm going to say goodbye, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. Or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.